Mother Knows Death presents External Exams with Nicole and Jemmy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's External Exam on Mother Knows Death. Today's guest is Mary Roach. So I wanted to tell you this. In 2007, I was in PA school learning how to do autopsies and stuff. And I was on my school break. And I thought, okay, I need to read a book that's for pleasure, but I'm a scientist, I'm a dork. So of course I wanted to read something that was about death, right? And I came across your book, Stiff, and I read it on the airplane on the way to Vegas with my friends. And I just can't believe that 15 years later, I'm talking to you right now. It's just such a crazy world.
Oh, that's hilarious. I'm sorry you had to read it on an airplane because I believe there's a chapter about the forensics of airplane crashes.
Exactly. Well, just working in this field, I think that I am completely scared at all times of everything. And it's funny, in this book, Gulp, you were talking about how hot dogs are, the Academy of Pediatrics or whatever said that hot dogs are one of the deadliest things for kids. And when I was... when I was rotating at the medical examiner's office, we had this case of this kid that was like 3 or 4 years old and was on the porch eating. And one of the people that were a neighbor that was sitting on the porch had given the kid a grape. And I mean, you know what I mean?
No. Same shape as the windpipe.
Exactly. But you don't. I think if you're a regular person, you don't really think about stuff like that. And the guy's just like, oh, here, kid, you want a grape? And then it was the neighbor's kid that died. Like, how horrible is that, you know?
Oh, you don't ever recover from that. Imagine the guilt. Yeah, nobody knows. I didn't know until somebody told me about hot dogs and grapes.
Yeah. So you're probably much like me, that you're constantly freaking out about stuff that you never knew about until you started doing research on it.
I know too much, Nicole. Not nearly as much as you do, though.
No,
I see everything.
You definitely know more than me. Trust me, I've read your books.
No.
I guess my first question is going to be the one that you probably hear all the time. I know that when I get interviewed, people always say, have you always been obsessed with death? And I'm like... And I'm like, no, I haven't actually. I wasn't like some goth, like 8-year-old, you know what I mean? But I've always been interested in how things work and breaking down things. And I'm assuming that you're the same way. So what made you decide, or not necessarily decide, or how did you fall into, you were going not become an official scientist where you go to a lab every day and work, and you were going to research about it and write it?
I didn't take science in high school or college. I was a liberal arts major, which of course prepares you for nothing in life. I shouldn't say nothing in life, but no specific job. So, one thing I could do is string words together. You do have to be able to do that to graduate. So I started as a general journalist, general writer, magazine writer, and one of the places I worked for in the early days of my career was a magazine called Hippocrates. It was a local. They were headquartered here in the Bay Area, and it was medicine and health and all things related. And they had a wonderfully lenient approach so that I could do things like say, oh, well, okay, so you want something about weight loss. What if I went to Tokyo and talk to sumo wrestlers about how they put on a massive amount of weight, and then tell people maybe they could do the opposite. Like, is there something there? And they'd be like, okay, go.
Oh, so, that's so cool.
So I wrote for them for a long time. It was a wonderful experience. But that was really how I came to writing about health in the human body. And Stiff grew out of a column I did later, similar subject area. So it was for salon.com. And Stiff was something that I had written one short piece about. I stumbled onto these books in the basement of the UCSF Medical School here in the Bay Area. And they had a row of books called the car crash conference, the papers of the STAP car crash conference. I'm like, what's a car crash conference? And I started looking through it, and they were talking about, this was the 60s and late 50s and the early days of automotive safety, where there were no seat belts, no airbags. The cars were just designed to look cool. And then they realized people were getting mangled and killed, and that maybe they should look into making them safer. And so to make a crash test dummy, for example, you needed the bodies to calibrate them. You know, the dummy would tell you what the force was and the acceleration, et cetera. But you had to know, what is that kind of force, or what does that do to a body? So they needed cadavers for that. So I had written about that. And then out of that column, the book kind of, agent contacted me and said, do you ever think about books?
Okay. Oh, that's really cool. So I guess when you posted articles with that content, it got a big response, obviously, because people are into it as much as they try to say, like, oh, don't talk about that stuff, it upsets people. But there's a huge population of people that obviously love that stuff.
And, you know, I think there's a kind of built-in fascination for cadavers, only because we're all going to end up that way. So it's personal to everybody in a weird way, you know, and everybody drives a car. So people are frightened by and kind of obsessed by that whole notion of a car crash. So I think it had that particular topic. Well, it was appealing to people, you know, it appeals to their curiosity, and it's a mix of curiosity and fear and, I don't know what else. But anyway, it turned out to be an okay mix for a book.
It's interesting that you talk about that, because that was one of my biggest things when everybody was freaking out about people dying from COVID and stuff. I was just like, you realize that there's a way higher chance of you dying in a car, right? But people don't want to think about that, you know?
No, I know. Some of that, especially towards the end of it, there were some conversations about, support wearing masks, you know, and then it was, you know, I'm not against that, but there was a point at which the people were talking about, I don't feel comfortable with whatever it was. And I'm like, you're in much greater danger driving to this event than you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Sitting there. I'm not anti-mask by any means, but just the level of hysteria at certain points was kind of, to me, bizarre.
Well, yes, because I'm a person has seen a lot of dead people in my life, like way before COVID ever started. So I know lots of people die every day. And you know that as well from your research. So I think for us, it was just like, people are dying. People die all the time. That's what happens. All right. So getting into Gulp. But the biggest thing that made me fall in love with your book was when you were kind of busted on your husband, because I love to bring my husband into things. And and when you were saying that about his farts in bed and being toxic gas, the hydrogen sulfide farts, I was like, that's so great, because that's 100% something I would do with my husband, too. He's married to you and loves you, and he likes that, right? Like he's cool with that. And
he's a very good sport. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Totally. And he's like behind, because of him, we have the line, I have this line that I love in the book. I think it's in the book anyway, where I don't know if it is, but I did a years ago story on flatulence, and, I was a subject in a study at the Beano Digestive Disease Research Center. And they said, well, first we need to find out, make sure you're a producer. Like, do you produce enough gas, right? So they have you blow in the Mylar bag. It's a breath hydrogen test. So then we have to know if you're a producer. And I said, yeah, I think I am. And I said, I think my husband is an executive producer.
That's so great. I love that.
All the best lines come from something to do with Ed.
Yeah, it's cool, because I feel like with my husband, we just constantly are going back and forth with these like insulting jokes to each other, kind of. But I love it. It's just,
what does
it's
he
really
do?
Great. My husband's a what firefighter.
Oh, okay, cool. So he's seen a lot too.
Oh yeah, but he like is really rough with me and the kids, like making jokes because, and he's just like, this is like sitting around the table at the firehouse. We just, they constantly rip each other, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's really good. So you've been on the New York Times bestseller 7 times, which is just like, you're such a rock star. It's, I mean, it's just really mind blowing, honestly. But of all of your books, of all those 7 books, which one is your favorite? That was your favorite to write or favorite?
Yeah. Well, the research for Packing for Mars, I loved because I got to go on a simulated zero gravity flight, you know, where the plane kind of goes in this roller coaster pattern. And as it goes over and down, you have like 20 seconds where you are weightless. You are floating like a soap bubble.
That's so
fun. So cool. It is just, and I had always wanted to experience that. So, and it took me a while to achieve that by pestering various people at NASA, but that was unbelievably fun. So the research for that one was, that might've been the most, and also I got to go up to Devon Island where they have a simulated, it's like an analog for Mars and Moon, it looks a lot like the moon up there. So they do rover and suit rehearsals and things. So, and I love that part of the world. So that was very cool to be able to do that for Packing for Mars. But, you know, Stiff, I have a certain fondness for because it was my first book and I thought it would absolutely fail. So, so excited when it hit the bestseller list.
It's funny that you might want to beat yourself up and think that that would fail. But then when I read it, I'm like, I know that in my line of work, there's just a whole entire world of people that are just want this so much. They can't get enough of it. And you brought it to mainstream, really, I would say, for the first time. You know what I mean? It's really awesome.
Yeah, it was around the time that I think the timing was good because it was the same year that the television show 6 Feet Under came out.
Oh, yeah.
And also CSI, I think the early CSI. So there were a lot of, bodies on slabs. There was a lot of, so the taboo kind of began to erode a little bit and people were able to feel comfortable being curious, which I think is healthy. And I think that helped a lot. But I think you're right. There's a tremendous amount of people who love this kind of thing.
I've had similar things with my content, with people thinking that these things only need to be available in medical textbooks and everyday people shouldn't see them. And I disagree. I think that because it's not just you're looking at gore, like you said, like you're learning, what do we look for? How do you prevent these things from happening?
Yeah.
It's all about education and just because you're not formally going to school for it doesn't mean that you have no right to learn about it, right?
I know. You think about the thing with Gulp. You have this, it's just one of the systems, but you have these things going on inside you that are freaking miraculous, and you never see them. You don't ever see your intestines while you can, if you stay awake like I did during your colonoscopy, you can. You didn't do that the second.
You know what's funny? Like, I wouldn't advise that because it's like when, you know, because they push the tube up there and they have to push air to expand the colon and it sounds like really juicy. Did yours sound like that? Like really?
No, I didn't remember. Maybe I was too traumatized by the pain when they were going around the corners. You know, that kind of stretches the colon.
Oh, God. Like,
I didn't notice the sounds until I was done. And of course, you fart them all out. Fart out all the air. But anyway, I stayed awake. He's like, okay, if that's what you want. And yeah, he's like, yeah, I want to see the, because I would like to be able to see your skeleton. You have this thing inside you that's going to survive you, that's in there. And you amazing thing, and you never see it. So why can't, any way you can allow people to share that miracle, frankly, is I'm all for it. So whether that's a specimen or, some of the things like Body Worlds, the plastinated specimens, whatever it is, I'm all for that.
Yeah. And obviously, like so many people are too. It's not a small, I feel like it's really not a small population at all. There were some really great points in your book that I'm going to give you my two favorite ones, quotes from your book. One, and I think that they're really simple, but a lot of people just don't get these concepts. One of them is, the more you eat, the more you overeat. It's just like, it's just very simple, right? You were talking about the chapter with basically eating too much that your stomach will explode. And a lot of things, because right now the big thing is like this Ozempic drug and weight loss and obesity is a huge thing, at least in my field, that we're seeing like all the time is just all deaths. People, a lot of younger people are obese. And it's a very simple concept to start with, that if you stretch your stomach out, then you're going to need to eat more food all of the time. So it just sounds simple, but I don't think that a lot of people realize that it's a muscle that you can overwork. The other is when you said that pharmaceuticals are in the business of treating, not curing. And I love that one too, because again, the pharmaceuticals are a huge part of, I mean, you should see, I don't know what your local drugstore is. Ours is called CVS. I don't know if you have them near.
Yeah, we have CVS.
But I mean, the place is just, it is crazy all the time. And I have a friend that works there that is a pharmacist who just tells me the most. So pharmaceuticals are a huge part of life. And I think a lot of people need to keep that in the back of their mind, that's
It's very sad when there's some of these relatively uncommon diseases, but rather than looking for because they're uncommon, first of all, there's not a lot of money to be made. And also to look for a cure, that's a one-time sale. So yeah. the ones that are money-making are chronic. So there's lots of research for ways to treat chronic conditions, because that's where the money is. I mean, you look at those ads for all the monoclonal antibodies, all the mAbs, you know, on TV, they're like $20,000 for an infusion. I mean, it's ungodly sums of money that those cost. And these are all chronic. It's often an immunosuppressive situation. They're like, irritable bowel and Crohn's or eczema or one of those chronic conditions. But anyway, yeah. And then there's some little lethal uncommon disease. They're like, nah, I'm not going to make anything up. Fuck those people. I mean, I get it. It's very expensive to go through the trials and to bring a drug to market. I understand that that's expensive and the finances don't make that a smart move. So I get why it happens. I mean, but it's unfortunate.
Yeah. In the book, you discussed this topic is something I've discussed before. You talk about you're talking about animal food, which is cool. I remember one of my biology teachers taught us that a really long time ago. Like they want to eat their own shit, but it needs to smell like just enough that humans could tolerate it in their house.
That was so interesting to me. He said, the cat is the customer in a sense. They're eating it, but really the customer is the owner. So if this stuff smells like shit, if it smells really awful, or if it, in the case of there was a cat food where they had pieces colored different colors and one was colored, dyed red. But then cats puke, cats throw up. So they would throw up, then the red would dye the carpet if you had a white carpet. So they're like, no, we're not going to use that anymore. But just, and also I love that they're very concerned with dog food. They don't want something that's going to be difficult to pick up. So the food is designed to make the shit pickupable.
God.
Right. They don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to get at with this is one of the parts you said that they were trying to make vegetarian cat food.
Oh, and yeah, yeah.
Obviously, cats are carnivores, right? So this is my whole argument often, since people, based on our teeth, are omnivores. What do you think? Do you feel kind of the same way when people say that being vegan is healthy or healthier than eating meat, or that it it's not like, or trying to just eliminate meat from our diets in general, when I feel like, as I always try to look at us as animals too, because we are technically.
Right.
And since we're omnivores, not to say that vegan people can't be entitled to that, but when they say it's healthier than meat, I kind of think, well, like, I don't know, we're supposed to eat. It's like saying
because of my most recent book, bears came to mind, and bears are omnivores, and they will eat meat, you know, they'll scavenge a carcass, they'll sometimes kill something, but mostly they're eating acorns and grasses and berries. And so I think being an omnivore is just sort of evolutionarily, it's kind of like, we can process anything, you know, good for us. We can eat meat. We can eat grains. Cause we've got the all purpose grinding machine and our digestion is set up to handle it all. So I think we just have more options. I don't know. I can't speak to whether losing meat. I mean, protein is important, but there's other sources. But I don't know that it's. I don't know what the facts are in terms of what's healthier. I know, you know, a Mediterranean diet is supposed to be healthy, but I don't. I mean, I don't. I eat meat.
I'm curious too, because you said that. Availability, like obviously 100 years ago, 300 years ago, there wasn't grocery stores that had pea protein sandwiches or whatever. Sure. But so that's interesting to me for as far as an evolutionary perspective, like if our teeth will start changing over, not anytime soon that we'll see, but over the course of hundreds and thousands of years because of the availability of food and stuff. That's just, it's interesting.
It is interesting because, yeah, you think if you don't need those things, you know, you look at birds that didn't, before they were predators, they're like, yeah, they didn't need to fly away because nobody was coming after them. You don't need those things.
Yeah, exactly.
That is interesting. I mean, it's a pretty slow timeline evolution, but who knows? I mean, presumably, yeah.
I know. I always worry about that. Like, not worry, but I think about that stuff just with the phones and this and that. I obviously we'll never be able to get to see it. How our skeletal system changes from sitting all day, or you know, and it's just it's kind of an interesting subject for me. All right, so in the grocery room, we could all agree that. I do post all the time, and the ones that seem to get the most, oh my God, I'm going to throw up. Occasionally, it'll be like eyeball ones or something. But most of us could agree that we get skeeved out by mucus in particular, like loogies that are coughed up.
Oh, yeah.
And
mucus is the worst.
It really is. And I used to work in, when I worked in the microbiology lab, I used to get the it was in the hospital, and I would get specimens to look for bacterial infections. And I would have to stick a swab like in a cup of it and play with it and put it on a petri dish. And I did that with urine, poop, whatever, you name it, no problem. But the sputum, that's what they called sputum. It just makes you like want to gag.
So, yeah, you know, I was going to say, no, go finish your question.
Okay. I was just going to ask you, like, while, because this is probably what you're about to say, like, while you were researching this book, was there one part of the GI system that in particular made you like?
Yes, it's the mouth, for sure. It's the mouth. And I'll tell you, this wasn't for Gulp. It was years and years ago. I was reporting a book. I was at this place, Hilltop Labs, where they test products that combat odor, like deodorants, douches, cat litter, and mouthwash. Okay, this is their little niche. They're in Cincinnati, or they used to be. I don't think they're there anymore, maybe. But anyway, I asked the main guy at Hilltop Labs, I said, what is the most disgusting thing? Because we were looking in the fridge, you know, their fridge is full of really rank stuff. I said, what's the most disgusting thing in here? What's the most disgusting smell? And he did not hesitate. He said, oh, hands down, incubated saliva. The smell, the smell of, I mean, it's like bad breath on steroids. You know, it's just a, a really rank smell. But the tick, and then saliva has also the, well, of course, there's two kinds of saliva. There's the, you know, the background one and the one that's the released when you're eating. So there's two different kinds, but regardless, the mucus element of it, you know, the kind of like, you know, an okra, if you don't prepare it right, that strand that comes up. And if I can't finish my gumbo, if there's that, it also, sometimes there's sort of like bubbles on the top that look like saliva. I'm like, I'm done. I love gumbo, but I can't eat that mucoid texture is bad. Yeah. It's that's, and just, and chewing the thing that we're doing when you think about it, that I was thinking about it quite a bit for that chapter, you know, what we're doing is, you know, we're taking something apart with our teeth and then moistening it with the saliva to form a bolus, which is
a gross word. It's a gross word, right?
I know. It should be like a heavy metal band. Bolus. Opening for Slayer.
Bolus.
But it's like, and I started, when I'm in a restaurant today, I started looking at people chewing. I'm like, oh, you're forming a bolus. I know what you're doing. And I was like picturing it. And it was kind of like, I was like almost feeling as though like, chewing and eating is something you should do behind closed doors, not sex. Like people should have sex in public and eat behind closed doors. Because when you're thinking about it, as I was, just that, you know, bringing the bolus together and then the bolus slithering down the tube. And then, I don't know,
the whole chewing thing
to me was somehow worse than the shitting.
You know what's interesting too? This is like a side note, but another argument that I always have is that with health insurance and stuff, like your teeth are typically not covered. And every time I go to the dentist, it's like $1,000 for something.
Yeah. And that's why it's not covered.
And it's, but it's like the first part of your digestive tract. Like you need, it's
I know.
Like, if it was your esophagus, it'd be like $5 copay. But here it's just like that. I don't understand it. I can't wrap my brain around it.
It is unbelievable to me that also vision. If you're like me, I'm like 20,000. I mean, I'm blind without my contacts. So if I couldn't afford to have corrective lenses, I'd be dead. I can't see anything. Because everybody ends up needing a significant amount of dental work, it's just, they're like, it's too expensive. We're not going to do it. But they've created this thing like, oh, dental, that's different. That's not part of it. It's like, what do you mean that's not part of it? It's the beginning of your gastrointestinal system. I mean, it's the beginning of your alimentary system. It's like you said, so important. And it's not covered.
I know. It may, like, I could see like veneers and stuff, obviously bleach, like cosmetic stuff. But
sure.
I have like a hole in, I had filling in a hole in my tooth and I keep biting my cheek so bad. And I'm like, this is when I eat, you know? So I need it fixed for eating. I don't care about it. Otherwise, I actually say to him sometimes, just like pull the tooth out. But then he says, oh, your teeth will get crooked and this, you know? But that's just a side note. Another cool thing.
And the other thing with that, if you have any problems with your jaw, that's part of the musculoskeletal system, the TMJ, the temporomandibular joint.
Yeah.
But because it's near, they call it part of the mouth, so they don't cover that.
Yeah.
Cover that. It's incredibly expensive, that things that people do for jaw disorders. And they'll go, oh, no, that's dental. We don't cover that.
And even like periodontal sometimes too is another thing. And like, really, actually, one of my friends, Dr. Lindsay Fitzharris, I don't know if you're, she just
wrote, I know her, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she's awesome. Oh, yeah. Her book, she was talking a lot about how the soldiers, a lot of their problems stemmed from periodontal disease and how it could be systemic if you get bacteria in your blood. Yeah. And it's crazy that they don't pay more attention to that.
Heart infections.
Yeah.
On the valve, the bacteria colonizes the valve of the heart and you get endocarditis. I mean, it's insane that that's not covered. But, it's all bottom line money.
That's what everything is, yeah. Every week on Mother Knows Death, we talk about all of these different stories that relate to posts that we have in the Gross Room. And I think you guys would really love it if you joined. Right now, you could join for only $5.99 a month and you get to see multiple posts a week. We have thousands of posts, pictures, videos over the course of years. When did we start the Gross Room? In 2019, yeah. And you can see all the way back. And it's just really awesome. If you have an interest in any particular topic, you could search by the title. Like I was just telling you about the guy that got impaled with the garden flag. And that is called Damage by Decoration. But you also could just search, like today I didn't remember what I called the post, so I just searched garden flag there and lawnmower. If you search lawnmower, all the lawnmower accidents will come up. So it's really awesome. And we have a great group of people in the Gross Room. So only $5.99 a month.
Yeah, so visit thegrossroom.com for more info.
So one of the cool things I learned in your book, so when I let me tell you this story and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. When I first started working in the lab when I was like 19, I go in there and they don't clean the labs a lot. So some of the stuff there has been there since like the 30s or the 40s. You know what I mean? Like nobody goes in and takes signs down. And there were signs in the lab that said no pipetting by mouth. And I was like, who the hell? This was in like 2000. So I was like, who would pipette by mouth? That's disgusting, right? And then some of the old heads that worked there that were like getting ready to retire, because I was 19 and there was people there that were like almost 70, right? They said, oh, yeah, we used to, a pipette's like a straw, basically, that you use a bulb to suck it up. But they're like, yeah, we used to do it with our mouth to suck the urine up and like put it into test tubes and stuff. And I thought that I was like, well, what if you get it in your mouth? And they said, well, you do something like that. Back then. I didn't realize that in your book, you were talking about like doctors actually tasting urine and stuff to check for diabetes.
Smelling, the urine would have a sweet taste, right? It's been a while since I looked at the book, but there was physicians were much more sort of involved with their senses, smell and taste, and because there were fewer diagnostic tests that you could order or send to the lab, they relied much more on their senses. Yeah, that was amazing to me. Yeah, that they would taste things and smell things.
Yeah,
it becomes part of your job, and it ceases to be strange or gross. See, I remember the only time I've ever gagged and had to leave the room because I was about to throw up, the only time was not anything from any of my books. It was, I'm friends with Judy Melanick, who she's in New Zealand now. She was a medical examiner here in Oakland.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And she has she does a lot on TikTok. But she said that she kind of made it a personal goal of hers to make me gag, I think. Because one day she goes, Bao Yang, I've got a couple of interesting specimens of the morgue today. Why don't you come over? And it was two people who had been found after weeks, and it was summer. I would say maybe after about a week, and it was a hot time in summer. And the bad smell, when she opened up that particular very bloated green specimen, I was just completely overcome and had to leave the room. She's like, what? It's not that bad. She goes, it's so different than a diaper. I'm like, it's definitely different than a diaper. But for her, it was just, and I'm sure for you, I mean, it's, you're just used to it.
I remember the first time I smelled it, and I was because I went to the medical examiner's office. I had to rotate there while I was in school. And when I every time I was there was the main part of the office, and the morgue was downstairs. And when I walked down the stairs, I was like, what the fuck is that smell? Like, it's not poop. It's just like dead fish poop. It's like every worst smell, urine, like all mixed together.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And when you multiply that, when it's a body that has been fully, like the peak of putrefaction, that is a really, and then, and Also, sometimes it would be mixed with the person had been drinking vast amounts of alcohol. There was that kind of sweet, sickly alcohol smell mixed in. It was really intense.
And it's funny because you do get used to it. And if you're ever walking down the street, and even if there's like a rat dead on the side of the road, you will instantly smell it now. And you will be like, something's dead near me. I don't know what it is, but I smell it. It's just so specific. But then I was at the ME's office for a whole summer. So obviously we had decomps every day in Philadelphia, right? But
decomps, yes, right.
Yeah, just like it was every day there. But by the end of the summer, I was like eating lunch down there. I was like, whatever. And that gets to my next topic, because you were talking about, you had a whole chapter about eating organs and stuff. And
yes,
when I first started doing autopsies, I couldn't eat ribs for a while. Like, they looked way too much like barbecue spare ribs. The fascia, really. That's like,
yes,
I can now. But organs, I still can't do. They have a very specific smell and a very specific look.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I like how you said that people are weird about eating organs, because it almost makes them feel like they're like an animal, like not, we're not like them, kind of, you know, when we are like them.
Right, right. I mean, I think the supermarkets and the purveyors of steak and cuts, pork, you know, whatever, roasts, they do a good job of making it, of divorcing it from the creature it came from. You know, it looks like meat. It doesn't have the same shape. It just doesn't look a little, you know, do chicken leg. That looks like a chicken leg. But anyway, it just makes it easier to deal with. And organs are on the other extreme of that. They're very much, you know, hey, that's that thing I have inside me.
And I get grossed out. Like, even last night, I put a chuck roast into the Instapot, right?
Yeah.
And it was raw. I just threw it in. And then when I opened it, I had to shred the meat. And just seeing like the bundles of, I could see like vascular component, like I can't turn it off. And then I saw the fascia and the bundles, and I was like, I like barely ate it. I was like, man, I try to turn it off so bad, but it's just hard.
Oh yeah. No, I remember as a kid, my mom, I don't know, we didn't have much money when I was a kid, and my mom would buy pretty cheap cuts of meat. And there was one, I remember, I could see the vein in the, like, coming through. And I was just so scared.
I know.
This one's supposed to be here.
I know. It's weird, right? Like, you have no problem eating it. And then I'm better like eating meat than, I don't like preparing raw meat too much, but chicken doesn't look anything like us, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember the first time I had tongue, it was on, I was heading down to Antarctica on this ship, and they made tongue. They didn't say what it was. Why would they? You know, and I was like, this is really good. This meat, it's really tender. I like it. What is it? And the guy goes, oh, it's tongue, lengua. And then suddenly I was like, I think I can feel the taste buds against my taste buds. Like, it
That's
ruined,
great.
Completely ruined it for me.
Oh my God.
A minute ago, I was really enjoying it. Yeah.
That's how it is. You're just like, don't tell me. Because one of the girls I used to work with, she was from China, and she would make dumplings all the time. And I was like, yo, dude, how do you make these? They're just so good. And she's like, oh, I just put leeks or whatever in, and I ate it. And she goes, you ate brain afterwards. And I was like, I never would have eaten it. But I was like,
Yeah. I was on a book tour in Japan, and my hosts took me to a restaurant, and they go, this is really good. And I go, oh, is that Mapo tofu? And she goes, well, similar. And I had it. And then I said, so, well, what was it? And she said, that was cod semen.
Ew. Yeah, you just don't want to know. You don't want to eat any semen from any animal, no matter what. All right. Mm-hmm. So the last thing I want to wrap it up with is that we have a mutual friend, Michelle. And one of the things that Michelle and I have always bonded with was our poop stories. And she's hilarious. She has openly said that she has shit outside I don't even know if she's told you all this stuff, but she has a really bad problem with getting diarrhea and just like having to go right then and there. And my mom's the same way, actually. She's probably...
Yeah, my brother has the Crohn's that comes and goes.
Oh, really?
He's okay right now, but for a while he's like 12 times a day.
Yeah, Crohn's is so terrible. It looks so painful.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yeah.
But my mom has it too, and she drives us nuts with it. We call it colon blow, actually. But
my mom had IBS. What's the other one? There's irritable bowel and
spastic
colon?
Or spastic, yeah.
Spastic colon is she called it that anyway. I don't know.
I think it would probably fall under that umbrella of that. And it's funny because it drives my dad nuts because they'll be driving over here and then like he has to stop at a gas station or something because she'll. And yeah. Michelle's kind of the same way.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't have that, but I can't imagine that there's a certain level of anxiety that goes with that, you know, in terms of traveling. My brother used to love to travel. And for a while there, he's like, what happened?
Yeah, I think that when I had it really bad when I was in my 20s and then it stopped. I think a lot of it is attached to nerves. And, you know, I had shitty boyfriend, literally shitty boyfriend at the time. Yeah. But yeah, so I was going to ask you if you had any embarrassing poop stories, but you would feel comfortable talking about that. Like,
I would definitely feel comfortable talking about them, but I'm trying to think if I was traveling. I was doing a story in the Amazon. And one of the things, I was traveling with an anthropologist who was studying the social economics of murder and how, and it doesn't matter, but we were going house to house in way out in the middle of the Amazon. And they would give you this bowl of chicha, which is a saliva fermented manioc, I believe. Anyway, and it was really rude. You had to take a sip, you know, because they'd bring it to you as you came in the house. And I was like, got spit in it. He said, no, you know, the savvy chicha drinker isn't worried about the spit. They're worried about the unfiltered well water. So you probably will get sick. And I was like, oh, great. Thanks. So I made it through the time I was there. But then as I was just arriving out, you know, leaving the jungle, fortunately I left it because I never would have made it to the outhouse. So staying in a hotel, and I it was so bad that I would wake up and I was afraid I wasn't going to make it to this bathroom. So I slept in a big hefty bag, plastic bag. I like pulled it up around me so that I didn't shit the bed. Cause it was one of those things where you're like shitting and puking at the same time. And then even with the hefty bag, I protected the bed, but I had this pair of underwear that I didn't quite make it in time. So they were a little bit soiled. So I was like, Jesus, I was too embarrassed to leave them in the trash. So I just threw them out the window and they caught in a tree branch.
Oh my God.
Hanging in there. I still remember they were green underwear with
this
brown patch hanging in the tree.
I think that's what's the greatest part about being human is that any person, no matter what, like has a story, especially just like as you get older, you're like the stories come more and more frequently. And I'm so envious of people. I mean, you seem like you overall have like a good GI. So I do now actually too. But like when I was younger, it was like it was bad. You know, I'd have to just as soon as I went into a restaurant, like scope out where and people have a really horrible time.
No, it is horrible. Yeah. No, I know. I've heard stories from some people in my husband's family, especially toward the end of his life, my father-in-law, you know, it was like scope out where is the closest bathroom. And that's disruptive. You know, you don't want to have to be. I think that, I mean, I don't know because I don't have that issue, but I would think that insecurity is as bad almost as the actual shitting.
Oh, yeah. I always say that the worst surgeries to have to get or the worst pathology to have is ones that have to do with your urinary tract or your digestive tract, because it's something you have to do multiple times a day.
Yeah.
And one of my brother's friends, a young kid in his 30s, he just had ulcerative colitis and had to have his entire colon removed. And while it was good, like he had to get a bag, which he just got reversed, and he didn't want the bag because it comes with all the other things that come with a bag. But he just said it was awesome because he could go out and like.
Yeah. No, in fact, I've talked to people for another project about that. And they're like, it was great to be not. I mean, you're just freed from all that. I mean, yeah, you have a bag, but you have some measure of control with the bag.
Yeah.
With an ostomy bag. And, you know, it's now you're free to go where you want and to travel, and you control, you know, when you change the bag. You know, you have a system and you know how long you need, and it is freeing. And, you know, people always assume, oh, my God, the worst possible thing in the world could be to have one of those bags. But that's not the case for most people who end up with them. It's actually freeing. To have that.
Anything that has to do with, you don't think about it every day, but it's like, even when he was healing from surgery, before he got the bag, it was like, you have to go to the bathroom that day after you just had something sewn back together that you have to push through. You know what I mean? It's just it's so scary.
No, when you have surgery, this, my brother, here I am, like, sharing my brother's private details.
We're all friends here. We all talk about all of our problems, trust me.
But he was talking about, you know, after the surgery, then you can get strictures from the surgery, you know, scarring.
Oh, God, it's such a mess.
And then that creates this sort of self-perpetuating cycle of blockages and surgery and strictures and more blockages and more surgery.
Yeah, it's so horrible. Sometimes I see, because I worked not only doing autopsy, but I worked in surgical pathology too. And I would just get these colon resections from people that you just feel so bad. You're like, these people have been through pure hell, and it just looks painful looking at it.
Oh my God, yeah. So inflamed and stretched out.
Oh my God, I can't imagine.
And those poor people with megacolon, you know, it's a Hirschsprung's disease.
Oh yeah.
Where they don't have the... They can't, there's no motility on the latter half, so that everything just sort of piles up and stretches the colon out, and then it gets really flabby and it doesn't work, and it's horrible.
I was thinking about that actually when you were talking about the specimen at the Mütter, because I'm not sure, I mean, I'm sure in other countries that still happens all the time that you would get, because that one is from an older person, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, it's from, I want to say, the early 1900s.
Yeah. So
Hirschsprung's, but now they would diagnose it and treat it much. That individual, I think that was, you know, untreated over years and years.
Yeah. So that's another reason why, because a lot of things that we take for granted in this country, and I have followers all over the world that send me cases, so I know a lot of still what's going on, and that will still happen in other countries that don't have medicine like we have here. And
yes,
it is important to see, even that would be super rare to see in America, like a 19-year-old with some, you know,
but yeah, absolutely. Or somebody with goiter, because now we have iodized salt.
Yeah. And there's lots of things like that. Like you still wouldn't believe though, some of the things that we do see, because people are just, they're in denial. There's all different reasons. People don't have money. People are scared. They're just scared of doctors.
No, I think that happens, that you somebody starts to get a symptom or a condition, and they're scared to learn what it is. And the worse it gets, the more scared they are. And then they just never go. And then they're in this very deep seated denial. And by the time they do get help, it's too late.
Yeah, that happened to a pathologist that I used to work with. She said she worked with another doctor who kept coughing a lot, and he thought that he had lung cancer and was scared to death and didn't go to the hospital. And then he ended up dying. And then when they did an autopsy on him, he had TB, which he could have treated.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's just sad when you hear stuff like that.
Yeah, very sad.
Are you working on any, I know you just came out with your most recent book has been over, it's been over a year now that it's been out, right? 21 it came out?
Yep.
How's that doing?
Fuzz was, it went really well. Yeah, that book did very well. It was great. I wasn't sure because it's a little bit of a departure for me. I'm usually writing about the human body or in some capacity or, you know, human bodies in unusual circumstances like combat or space. So Fuzz was a departure, and that I had a lot of trepidation and a lot of anxiety, but it was well received. Yeah, it was fun. It's still the same sort of goofy all over the map approach that I seem to take, it was fun. It's a book about people and animals getting in each other's way. Human wildlife conflict.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think that anything you write, people are going to be into because it's your style, and that's what they like, your style and learning from you. Because I have been in a GI track, hands in a GI track, and yes. I learned so much. Just
because, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah,
you know, really, I did. Yeah. I loved it. And you won't even believe this, but I don't really like to sit down in the corner and read because I have kids and it's always crazy in my house. So I put the audio book on and I like to cook. I'll be in the kitchen for hours. Like I home make a lot of pasta and stuff.
Yeah.
And my husband kept walking in the kitchen and he's like, what the fuck? He walked right in when you were talking about the anal sex stuff or it was the end with the constipation and all that stuff. Yeah. And he's like, what? And I'm like, listen, dude, I could eat a hamburger over a dead body. This doesn't really gross me out to cook and do this. So it's awesome. I love it. Are you working on it?
I am.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm the same way. Every now and then, though, I see somebody reading stiff while they're, I think twice this has happened, while they're eating at a restaurant. I'm like, you are my people. You're eating and reading that book.
Yeah, exactly.
I am working on another book. I'm not really talking about it in specifically what it's about, but it is, I'm back in the human body.
Oh, that's exciting.
So, yeah.
I'm excited to see what that's going to be because I'm like, oh, because I love the way that you broke down the GI track, and I'm like, okay, she needs to do every single cardiovascular systems, the reproductive, you could do everything now.
But, the nervous system and the brain have been done so well, Oliver Sacks, David Eagleman have done those so well. The reproductive system gets a lot of, there's a bunch of books on that. I feel like the alimentary canal and the intestines and the anus, I'll do that. I'll take that one. I'm the bottom feeder. I'll do that. So, I think it was Mukherjee did something on the heart recently?
Yeah.
Cancer. Didn't he recently do something on the heart? Anyway, I feel like some of those systems have very, very erudite and scholarly minds applied to them. So I might not go there, but I'll always figure something out.
Well, so nice to have you. It was an honor to meet you. It's just, I'm kind of starstruck and, I said to my husband, I was like, she's such a big deal. So I'm just so excited that you did this for us.
Oh, so happy to. I'm so happy to, we're two peas in a pod, you and me. So it was a natural fit and a really fun conversation.
Awesome.
So,
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Mother Knows Death. As a reminder, my training is as a pathologist assistant. I have a master's level education and specialize in anatomy and pathology education. I am not a doctor and I have not diagnosed or treated anyone, dead or alive, without the assistance of a licensed medical doctor. This show, my website, and social media accounts are designed to educate and inform people based on my experience working in pathology so they can make healthier decisions regarding their life and well-being. Always remember that science is changing every day and the opinions expressed in this episode are based on my knowledge of those subjects at the time of publication. If you are having a medical problem, have a medical question, or are having a medical emergency, please contact your physician or visit an urgent care center, emergency room, or hospital. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Mother Knows Death on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or anywhere you get podcasts. Thanks.